Welcome to this podcast called Curious About Recovery. I am Kirsten Honeyball. I am your host. And in this podcast, I'll be diving deep into eating disorders, which are complex and challenging to navigate. So whether you're a sufferer, a professional, a family or loved one of a sufferer, you can join me as I get curious by interviewing professionals, chatting to eating disorder survivors, and sharing my personal experience with an eating disorder so that you can better understand various perspectives, remove stigma, hear inspiring testimonies, and simply get curious about all things eating disorder related. I would like to put out a trigger warning. These episodes explore the topic of eating disorders, and some content may be triggering to listeners. Topics explored may mention, but are not limited to, trauma, diets, food and body types, suicide, mental illness, substance use, self-harm, violence, gender identification topics, and more. Please take care before listening to any episodes. It's important to note that this podcast is not aimed to diagnose, treat, or cure any form of mental illness and should not be seen as a replacement for treatment of eating disorders. Everything said here is expressed in relation to personal and professional opinions, and listeners should be encouraged to view these episodes as an open-minded exploration of various possibilities and perspective rather than hard facts and solutions. Please take what applies or resonates with you and leave the rest. And if you're struggling with an eating disorder, don't hesitate to reach out to me at kirsten@kirstenhoneyball.co.za. I am having a chat with Courtney Vickery, who is a dietitian, intuitive eating counselor, food therapist, and body image coach. She is from a small rural town in Georgia and has been married to her high school sweetheart for 12 years. She has two awesome kids who are always making her laugh, and she has a little dog and a cute kitties, all rescues who are abandoned by their previous owners and are living the life of luxury now. She is a Harry Potter and Jurassic Park enthusiast and loves science fiction books and movies. She has quite a few qualifications under her belt in education programs that she's been through and trainings that she has been on. You can check it out on her website. Everything from nutrition counseling for eating disorders, body image training, certified intuitive eating counselor, yoga teacher. She runs Vickery Wellness and aims to provide a weight-inclusive and anti-diet approach to nutrition in a safe, diverse, and non-judgmental space. She values empathy, compassion, inclusion, and integrity, and strives to build long-lasting relationships with her clients. Her goal is to empower clients to feel good in their own skin and flourish on their own terms. As a part as her commitment to this, she makes monthly donations to Diversified Dietetics and fully supports their mission to increase their racial and ethnic diversity in the field of nutrition, empowering nutrition leaders of color. She offers a range of nutrition and body image courses and has a bunch of free resources as well that you can check out on her website, which is vickerywellness.com. Today, we're going to be speaking to her a little bit about her experience, what brought her to doing the work that she does today, and the things that she learned along the way, such as the prevalence of eating disorders in college students, how to raise anti-diet kids, and some tools for coping when it's really tough in the beginning when you're trying to recover from an eating disorder. So I'm really happy to have you here, Courtney. Please, would you give me a little bit more about who you are, how you got here, and yeah, anything you feel like you want to share with the audience?
So yeah, I actually developed an eating disorder when I was 8, and in the States, that's the third grade. And I didn't really recover until I was 22 when I was in college and I met the right treatment team for me. I had tried other treatment teams, and I really think it's just so important to find the one that works best for you. And I was also studying political science at the time and thought I wanted to be a lawyer. So I didn't want to study nutrition when I was in the middle of recovery because I didn't want to tempt fate. And so I stuck with political science, and then I worked in that field for about a year, and it was not for me. So I finally decided to go back and had to in some way start all over again because I didn't have any sciences. So I had to go back and do all of the prerequisites for dietetics. And then I stayed at the University of Georgia and did my master's in dietetic internship and became a dietitian. Then after that, I worked inpatient, doing neurosurgery floors, med-surg floors, all of the clinical aspects. And then I worked as an outpatient dietitian and was able to kind of create a ground-up program for that wellness center. And then I was promoted to be the healthcare administrator, where I was over three different departments at the hospital. And then in the pandemic, I decided I didn't want to do that anymore, or I couldn't do that anymore. So I left and decided to open my own private practice, helping people with disordered eating, because no matter where I was during my time as a dietitian, inpatient and outpatient, it seemed like those people just gravitated to me because they, I don't know, maybe they felt safe with me, but that's just kind of always where I've been passionate about. And it's been, you know, really fulfilling to be able to help that population in my own practice.
I think it's really beautiful to witness people who have gone through the struggle of disordered eating and then come out to not only then find their recovery and all of that, but then to further go and help other people, because it's such a difficult path to navigate. And, you know, you spoke now about how you struggled with this until you were in college, and you've recently spoken about the prevalence of disordered eating in college students. I know this is where my eating disorder spiraled as well. So just your thoughts and what you've shared on the prevalence of this illness in college students, the triggers, maybe why this environment can be challenging, and what we can do as parents or teachers or anything like that to help people that are in this position.
So there's actually a lot of data that shows that during the time that we're 18 to 21, which is obviously when most of us are in college, that there is a higher risk of developing an eating disorder. So there was actually a survey by the National Eating Disorder Association in 2013 that estimated between 10 to 20% of women and 4 to 10% of men in college suffer from an eating disorder. And it also found that 4 of 10 students have either experienced an eating disorder themselves or they know someone who has. And especially athletes, student athletes, they are at a much greater risk of developing an eating disorder compared to non-athletes. Obviously, that is just an environment that focuses a lot on nutrition, which can be helpful, but can also kind of become a little bit obsessive and disordered as well. And people always wonder, you know, what is the reason that this becomes more prevalent during this time? And I mean, there's probably, I know that there's a lot of mixture of reasons, but the biggest things that I think trigger it are the fact that they're on their own for the first time for most of us. There's a lot more responsibility. There's a lot more stress if we don't come into that atmosphere or environment with having coping skills that are appropriate, then, you know, we can then put the eating disorder in the place of a coping skill. You know, we don't have the, maybe not the same support system that we have at home. We're away from our parents, our friends that we grew up with, and other support family or friends. And there's a ton of food choices, food-centered activities, change in routine, a loss of structure in some ways, and not just academic stress, but also financial stress. And then of course, and a lot of people talk about the freshman 15, so they may be afraid of gaining weight, so they take it to an extreme. So, you know, I think those are the ones that are specifically related to college, but I also think that there's sort of this perfect storm that occurs with anyone who develops an eating disorder or disordered eating based on their history or any trauma in their past or any, you know, co-occurring issues.
And I definitely think the environment of, you know, college environment, like you said, it's people kind of having all the responsibility and no responsibility all in one go, if that makes sense. And it's so important because, you know, the empowerment the personal empowerment in eating disorder recovery comes from taking responsibility for oneself and one's choices and one's actions. And if one hasn't gone into a space where they can learn healthy coping mechanisms and how to self-regulate and dealt with trauma and all of that, and now they're in this environment where it's like, whoa, they can do anything, you know, and then, you know, drugs and alcohol become involved and there's different pressures and all of that. So I can definitely understand how this is an environment where a lot of people can spiral.
Do you know of anything that's being done to try and support people in this position? Or where do you think the gaps are? What can we do as maybe college facilities and institutes to help these people?
Yeah. So, I mean, I think that would probably be another soapbox as far as what the United States can do for mental health. I'll speak specifically to colleges and universities. So, and specifically, I can talk to like what I know the University of Georgia has done. I know that we have the health center, which most campuses have, but they also have people that are dedicated to working with disordered eating and eating disorders. So they have a team, they have a physician who has experience and knowledge of eating disorders, because that is very important. I'm always hesitant to send any clients or patients to a physician who doesn't have experience with eating disorders, because they're just, you know, for example, one thing that most people don't know is that once you go through a period of starvation, your cholesterol levels will be high most of the time. So if you go to a physician who doesn't understand that mechanism, and then they do your labs, and then they try to tell you to eat healthier, that's very triggering for most people in recovery. So having a physician that understands that's really important. And then, of course, they have a team of dietitians who have experience in that area. And then they have the mental health services with the therapists and social workers there. And they do individual and group sessions. I know when I was a student, we had an organization called For Loving Yourself. And we, you know, worked on campus to spread awareness about eating disorders. Because I feel like it's such a fine balance between educating people on what the flags are for, you know, people in your life who may have disordered eating, but also not giving other people ideas. Because I know that that was something for myself that happened. I remember specifically watching an episode of Oprah, and there was someone on there who was bulimic, and they shared too much. They shared too many ideas. I'm sure that maybe on the other side of that, people were educated on what to look for. But on the other end, it also gave some people ideas. So very fine balance, I think.
100%. I think it's such a fine line. And I think it's definitely a gap where the education system perhaps hasn't, I mean, I see the intention, but perhaps hasn't got it quite right yet. Is just because we're telling someone what something is doesn't mean we're helping the situation, you know. And I had the exact same experience. I had to do a project for school, and we had to research bulimia and eating disorders. And I found all the information and all the tools. And, you know, if you look at a substance use disordered person, and you go to them and you like tell them about this new drug, you know, like they're probably going to want to try it. So very important, you know, like we're looking at as college institutions and all of that, looking at, you know, how are we supporting people? Are we actually supporting them in a way that is helping them, or are we just telling them facts? Then the importance of having things like dietitians that are aware, and therapists that are trauma-informed, and physicians that have experience, and all of that in a team that is readily available for young people to go and access should they wish to. So, yeah, you've highlighted a lot of stuff there. And in your experience, how easy was it for you to come forward as a person who needed help with an eating disorder in college? Like, how did you process that?
I think it's interesting because, at least when I was in college, and I would imagine it's similar now in some ways, that disordered eating or aspects of disordered eating are praised, right? So if you eat really healthy, if you're, you know, really militant about what you're eating, and you really, I mean, I had a food blog and I posted all the things I ate. I was a fitness instructor. And I would sometimes teach like up to 10 classes a week, and people were like, that's so amazing, you know, and people praise people for losing weight and all those things. So it's interesting to be in that situation where people see you as being so quote unquote healthy, when inside you're literally dying. And they just have this perception in their mind that people with eating disorders are only really, really, really underweight people. And that's not always the case. The majority of them are not underweight, but they're still doing harmful things to their body. So to answer your question, I think at that point I was desperate because I had been in it for so long. and really was afraid that I was going to die at some point because I couldn't keep doing it.
So it's almost like the severity of your illness kind of forced you into self-preservation and self-care and healing. And I can definitely relate to that. And I think a lot of the time people think, oh, I have to wait until it gets that bad before I can do anything. So how would you encourage or what would you say to people who maybe it hasn't gotten to the point of desperation yet and they're in college and they see the signs and they notice the things? Like, what do they do?
Yeah, I mean, I always tell people you don't have to be quote unquote sick enough. There is no sick enough. If it is affecting your life on a daily basis, if you are feeling affected and exhausted by these things at every meal and you're constantly thinking about food and your weight, that's not how you have to live. There is another way to be able to be in the moment and think about other things besides what am I going to eat next? How many calories are in this? When am I going to work out? That's a half-life in a way.
Mm. And I think a lot of people are stuck in this restrict, binge, guilt, purge, whatever, over exercise, whatever. And it becomes a little bit of a cycle. And sometimes it can be praised at first by people, you know, like even things like modern diet fads and all of that are praising certain disordered eating behaviors. So when you, as a professional, help someone start breaking this restrict, binge, perhaps purge, guilt cycle, where do you start? And what do you think a person needs to focus on as a priority in this process?
Yeah. So I can kind of walk through what my process is for getting started with someone, which is I have a very long intake session. It's at least an hour and a half, which sometimes people are like, that's kind of long, but it never is shorter most of the time. And we really just dive into their history with their relationship with food. I mean, to the point that my questions are things like, what is your first memory of food? Like, what foods hold sentimental value for you? Prompting questions like that. And then we talk about their history with their body image or their body in general. On my intake questionnaire, they have the opportunity, they don't have to, but they have the opportunity to disclose whether they are a victim of trauma in some way. And then we talk about their hunger and fullness cues. We talk about their patterns around food. And I always tell them, I'm not looking at the food necessarily. I'm definitely not looking at calories. I'm looking at patterns. Like, are you nourishing yourself on a regular basis, or are you starving yourself all day and then eating and past fullness at night and feeling uncomfortable about it and then compensating for it in some way that is not benefiting your body? So, to get started, I think it obviously depends on where they are and like what stage of change they're in. Most of the time when people come to me, it's one of two things. It is they are kind of being, in a way, forced to come see me because of parents or family that are concerned. And so they do it because, you know, they have to. But eventually they realize that, you know, they do need help and it is helpful most of the time. But the majority of clients that come to me in this, you know, outpatient private practice setting are ready and they want help. So I think that obviously makes my job a little easier compared to like an inpatient setting, possibly. But the biggest thing is really practicing that permission, like giving yourself permission to eat and to permission to not feel guilty about it, which is really scary because that means letting go of some control. And the control is what leads to the restricting and then the binging, possibly, and the purging. And I always say binging in quotation, because there's obviously, you know, there's not like a set line, like this is definitely a binge. I always tell people if it feels out of control to you, then it probably would be considered a binge for you. You know, like I remember when I was in group treatment that I don't remember exactly what we were talking about, but another member was shocked that I didn't quote binge. I restricted and then would purge. Just, you know, like I was both. So everyone's story is very different. So it really depends on the person. But I think the biggest key is giving yourself permission to eat without wanting to compensate for it, which is obviously sounds very simplistic, but it's very, very difficult.
So how does one deal with that guilt when one is starting to eat? I mean, it's a very deep thing that people feel. So how do they deal with that?
We'll always work in tandem with a therapist. So I always tell them, like, I can work on helping you in the moment with coping skills. And we usually come up with what I call their toolbox of skills. And it has to be realistic things. It can't be it can be if it really works for them, but it can't just be, okay, well, I'll go take a walk. Because I always say, are you really going to do that? Like, in the moment, it has to be something that's just as easy as your normal go-to for your, you know, either purging or binging or whatever it may be. It has to be just as easy as that, because if it's not, then we're not likely going to choose it in that moment, because it's hard, because we want to go to the thing that's the most comforting in the moment for us, which is the binging or the purging possibly. So I tell them, like, even if it's just walking outside, literally just walk outside, a change of scenery, some fresh air. And that's something that can be very, very simple versus I got to get ready to go for a walk. There's too many steps. It has to be one step. But, I deal with things in the moment like that. But then I think working in tandem with a therapist is very important, because the therapist can go back into the history and if there is trauma or anything like that, and really working through a lot of that really deep core issue. And then I can also come in and help with the in the moment specific things and moving forward, and helping them develop those tools that can help in the moment.
So, I mean, just out of interest, what things helped you in the beginning? You know, like, what was easy for you?
Yeah, that's a good question. I'm trying to think back. It's been, luckily, been so long now. In the beginning, honestly, fear of hurting myself more. Like, fear of how many more times can I keep restricting and purging and working out so many hours a day without my heart stopping. So fear is a motivator in those moments. But as far as like tools that I used, I journaled a lot at that time. Journaling, which I know is cliche, but it is helpful if it's something that works for you. And I had to change my relationship with exercise. It had to stop being punishment. It had to stop being calories burned. It had to start being fun and hanging out with my friends, or going for a walk and talking with my friend and walking my dog, and not about my body. Because, I mean, exercise can be a stress reliever. It's just when we take it too far. So I'd say journaling, reading. I read a ton. My husband always laughs because I read the entire Harry Potter series in 2 weeks. So, you know, reading a ton. Now I don't have as much time to read because I have 2 kids. So it's just like, they don't let you read. I went to the beach this past week and I read 1 chapter on 1 day. Because that's all I could do. But reading, journaling, walking, exercising for fun, and therapy, honestly, like, you know, reaching out, if you have a therapist and they have, you know, said that they can, you know, do any kind of support or chatting in between, then use that. I tell my clients that all the time, because I give chat support, you know, and I always tell them, don't worry about whether or not it's a, you know, something that we can talk about in between sessions, just send it to me anyways. And I will always let you know, like, you don't have to worry about me rejecting you or making you feel uncomfortable or silly for saying something. If it helps you to get it out, then go ahead and, you know, I'll either respond with some ideas or suggestions or support, or I'll say that sounds like a really great thing for us to talk about at our next session. So I'm going to put it in our notes for next session.
I completely agree with that. I think I actually read something this morning about how that process of sharing in eating disorder recovery is critical. And I saw a direct relation in my ability to start maintaining recovery versus how much I was actually allowing people into the process and letting them know, like, okay, right now I'm struggling, you know. Super important. You said, you know, you have 2 kids. That's amazing. I mean, just even a testament to your journey. I mean, a lot of people who have history with eating disorders never get the ability to have children. And it's just wonderful that you can be a parent and, you know, raise anti-diet kids. So, I mean, how do you approach? I mean, you obviously have to, like, allow them the space to figure out what they love and what they enjoy and take your diet culture mentality. I mean, I'm not saying you have diet culture mentality, but one has to take diet culture mentality, you know, out of the process and raise an anti-diet kid. How does that look for you and how can it look for parents?
Yeah. I mean, I always kind of laugh at myself because I'm probably obviously much more sensitive and aware of things that people say that they don't even realize that it could be harmful. So I'm always on alert of like what, especially like my husband, for example, might say something and he wouldn't say anything obviously negative or diet culture-y on purpose. But like if he's body checking and the kids are around or even myself, I'm like, stop body checking. Like I just tell them like, don't body check because they're watching everything we do. They hear everything we say. So, you know, we can't do those things and then expect them not to do those things. So I think that, and then not obviously demonizing food, not calling food junk food, not telling them, you know, it is such a hard balance because my daughter is neurodivergent. So she's very much wants the science of like, why, like, you know, why can't I have just popsicles for dinner? So then I have to walk through and say, they are very yummy and you can have popsicles with dinner. Like I never say you have to eat this first and then you can have that because then that puts that dessert on a pedestal in a way. You can have the popsicle, but we need to have something to go with it so that we can make sure that we have energy and we're full and we're able to go play later and our body can grow strong, et cetera, and get all the nutrients we need. And I go into like, you know, this is why we need vitamin C and vitamin A, and this is where we can get it. So that works for her because that is how her mind works. But I could also see how for some kids that wouldn't work because maybe they would get worried about it or think, you know, they had to eat a perfect way. So like for my son, I just want him to eat. He just turned 3 actually on Saturday and he doesn't eat. So that's something I struggle with him. I obviously want him to enjoy food, but yeah, luckily my daughter loves food and eats whatever she wants. And I have really enjoyed seeing that because again, mine started at a young age and, you know, at 8, she's 7. So that means in a year she would have, you know, I just can't imagine her that young walking around with a calorie counting book. Cause that's what I had. And eating only salads for meals and eating, you know, a piece of fruit for a breakfast and that's it. So there's no way that she could sustain the energy levels that she has. So I take a lot of advice from my friend Diana, who is anti-diet kids on Instagram. And she has a lot of good information because I only have experience as a mom. I don't have like pediatric experience like she does. But she specifically works with that population and has a lot of good information too.
That's awesome. So if you are listening to this podcast, at Anti-Diet Kids is another place you could get a resource for just looking at how to encourage, motivate, support, and educate your kids in a loving and holistic way when you're raising anti-diet kids. So that's super, super cool. You know, and on top of the amazing work that you do in helping people educate, in helping educate and help those people with eating disorders, you also have a design company that helps weight inclusive health providers set up their branding, websites, etc. So I'd love to know more about that you do.
I've always done some kind of design on the computer. Like since I was a kid, I always joke, like I even, you know, I remember playing in MS Paint. I don't know if anyone remembers that, but you know, I would play in that and make things. And it was just something I did for fun. And when I was in college, I had a blog, like I said, so I had a website that I did myself. And my resume in grad school was an interactive website that I would, like my portfolio that I would send people to. And then when I started my practice, like the most fun part for me was creating the website. And I redid it so many times because I, you know, just had fun doing it. But then I started having people ask me like, who did your branding? Who did your website? And I would say, I did it. So then I started having some local people especially ask me for help with theirs. And I don't do anything kind of halfway. So I had to like do it the right way. So I started an LLC and like got everything set up. And it was kind of crazy because in the first, you know, month of this year, I ended up having 5 clients, like 5 websites, because even though some of the people I kind of knew through groups I had been in, but some of them literally said, as soon as I saw you were weight inclusive and that you were a dietitian that worked in this field, I knew I had to work with you because nobody understands what I'm doing. They hear dietitian and they think weight loss, or they think they're going to put pictures of fruit on my website. And I don't want that, you know, I don't want the apple with the tape measure going around it that everyone tries to use on our websites. So yeah, it's been really fun. Like I said, I have one more website that's finishing up right now. And so that's the five I did in the first half of the year. And then I've done branding updates for several other dietitians and personal trainers that are weight inclusive too. So it's just been really fun to take their vision and kind of bring it to life. And I'm also the lead designer at Pursuing Private Practice, which is a Jennifer McGurk's dietitian business school, her beginner basics course. So she helps dietitians who are anti-diet start their own private practice. So I've had fun updating their web pages, you know, for different launches and things that they're doing too.
That's so awesome. I love how you've taken your creative element and flair that came naturally to you from a young age, and you've used it in conjunction to this thing that you're very passionate about. And I say I love it because I relate to it, because I'm an audio engineer. So like I'm taking audio with the podcast and putting it together with the ED stuff. And so, I mean, like if anyone out there who is listening is a weight inclusive health provider and they are needing branding and websites done or anything like that, please feel free to reach out to Courtney, and she'll definitely be helping you in that sector. So just a couple of more questions. I'd love to find out, what is the highlight of your career as a dietitian and as a designer been?
I mean, I would say finally being able to open my own private practice, because I, you know, always joke I've been an entrepreneur since I was a kid. I had my parents own their own business, and pretty much everybody on my side of the family owns their own business. There's several entrepreneurs doing something. And I had a lemonade stand as a kid. I remember one summer I drew pictures and then used my parents' copying machine to make coloring books to sell to the people that came into the store, you know, for their kids. So I was trying to think of things to do. So I thought that was pretty creative. But yeah, I've just always really enjoyed having my own business and doing the admin side while also, you know, doing the customer service side. So I think being able to finally do that has been really fulfilling, because I think that's the one positive thing I can take from the pandemic, because I think before that I was too scared because I thought I had to have this, you know, job and keep climbing up the ladder and, you know, in at the expense of my own mental health and my family's time. So
I love the image of climbing up the ladder. And I just thought to myself, well, you're creating your own ladder, you know, and you're at the top of it all the time. That's just a silly little thought. So do you have any words or message or encouragement for those who are out there struggling with the eating disorder, who maybe don't know where to start or finding stumbling blocks and how they can feel supported?
The only reason I ever hesitate is because I don't want to tell someone to go reach out to a loved one if they don't feel comfortable doing that. But I do want them to know that there are people out there who understand you and can help you. And sometimes we just have to find that person, find that right therapist that's a good fit for us. You know, I would hate for someone to go to someone who's not a good fit and then just kind of say, I'm never going to therapy again. Give someone else a chance, try to let them in as much as you feel comfortable until you find that right person. Because I do believe there are people out there who really understand you and your specific situation.
So a really amazing message of support and encouragement is that you don't have to be alone. There's always going to be someone who understands your story and someone who is not only willing, but also capable of holding that story with you. So really wonderful. Just reach out to whoever you feel comfortable reaching out to, and knowing that sharing is critical in the recovery process. So I'd love to know how we can get hold of you, and, you know, what are your social media handles, all of that stuff for anyone who wants to know a little bit more about you.
So my private practice is Vickery Wellness, and the website's vickerywellness.com, and Instagram handle is Vickery Wellness, shockingly. And my website and branding studio is Declet Designs, DECLET.com. And then the Instagram handle is also Declet Designs.
That's really awesome. Thank you so much for your time today. It's been wonderful chatting to you. And I think you have such valuable insight. And I'm sure everyone who's listened today has got a lot of value in what you've had to say. So thank you very much. And it's been a pleasure getting to know you.
Yes, thank you so much for having me.
Thank you so much for listening to today's podcast. If you have liked it, share it with people who you think might benefit from listening to it as well. Don't forget to go to my Instagram page called @curiousaboutrecovery to find out about upcoming episodes or to browse the episodes of the past. You can also follow my page called @KirstenHoneyball, where you can get inspiration for your eating disorder recovery.